Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And today's episode with CJ Wilson, former major league pitcher and co-author of the new book, Bitcoin and the American Dream, the new monetary technology transcending our political divide. But first, I wanted to tell you about our amazing sponsors. First up, new sponsor, CipherSafe. I hope you guys have taken custody of your Bitcoin and gotten it off the exchanges. Because you know, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. Now go that extra step and secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure with a Cypher wheel or the new CypherGrid seed storage device. CypherSafe's goal is to provide important tangible security tools for Bitcoin, a fourth generation machine shop. CypherSafe continues that tradition of inventing mechanical products, focusing now on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured all in-house, machined from solid stainless steel, not stamped out, waterproof, fireproof, rustproof, Cedric-proof, go to CypherSafe.io to purchase your Cypher wheel or Cypher grid and keep your sats safe. And use the code MATRIX for 10% off your order. Citadel Cabins is in the custom building industry, and they are famous for small log cabins that can be shipped anywhere and easily assembled in just a few days without any specialized skills or power tools required. It's kind of getting crazy out there, and I'm thinking more and more about an escape plan, a retreat, or even an extra room at the house. Citadel Cabins is a Bitcoin-only company that exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. As we descend deeper and deeper and deeper into clown world, the cabins are creating a way for families to escape and establish KYC-free location sovereignty, surrounded by people who care about freedom as much as we do. Or maybe you want to get off the grid completely. If you are a landowner, investor, renter, or you want to provide support via your labor or expertise, Citadel Cabins has a program that's right for you. Citadel Cabins has partnered with Untapped Growth, and for each cabin sold, they donate a portion towards their efforts in regenerative agriculture, Citadel community building, and beef production. Head over to CitadelCabins.com for more information and to fill out an application now. Ledin offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans with the best rates in the entire industry, enabling users to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell your existing holdings. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast can get a free $50 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. To learn more, sign up at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Bitcoin 2022 will be held on Miami Beach from April 6th to 9th, and you can use the code Bitcoin Matrix at checkout to get a 10% discount on your tickets. All tickets are transferable and 100% refundable if you are unable to travel due to COVID restrictions. Going to the Bitcoin conference will change your life. It's an investment in yourself, and it'll help you stack more sats if you do it right. Remember, use the code Bitcoin Matrix for 10% off your tickets at b.tc/conference. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with CJ Wilson, who I bumped into over the summer at Bitbok Boom, and after catching up for a bit, I knew I had to have him back on the show to find out what he's been up to this year.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
CJ Wilson is the co-author of Bitcoin and the American Dream, the new monetary technology transcending our political divide. CJ is also a former major league pitcher. He currently is a Porsche Audi BMW dealer in Fresno, California, podcasting Bitcoin hodler, grinding towards his goals every day, block by block. CJ is a family man who loves driving race cars on Sunday and stacking sats on the rest. CJ Wilson, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Thanks, Ed. I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm all the way in the Bitcoin Matrix, I guess you could say these days.
So yeah, man. You're really deep. I kind of see you everywhere in terms of tweets in different places around the country. We got to meet up in Dallas at Bitblock Boom. That was pretty cool. Yeah, like tell me a little bit about where you've been this year.
So 2021 has been a super tornado of Satoshis. I went to BitBlock Boom. I was at the Miami conference. I've been in DC a couple times as a Bitcoin advocate, talking to senators and Congress. You know, I'm doing some mining stuff. So I've been visiting different mining sites in different places, exploring some different places to mine. Obviously living my normal life as a family guy here in California, also doing some deals for Bitcoin in terms of like car deals with Bitcoin, using that as another abstraction layer to try to bring in more clients and stuff. So I've actually recruited some clients from other places as a result of them, me being friendly with, I guess, crypto broadly, you know, in that regard. But it's been everywhere. It's been fun. It's the Bitcoin rabbit hole. You start and you're like, oh, this is a good layer. And then you're like, you just keep digging and digging and digging. And suddenly you're, you know, you thought you were only going to hang out in like 6 foot deep level. Then you're 38 feet deep. But you're like, wait a second, there's still more there. I need to keep exploring these other tunnels. You know, it's fun.
Yeah, it's been really wild to watch all the things you've gotten involved in this year. I'm kind of curious, when did you start kind of thinking or tracking or watching like markets?
Yeah, so trading for me is something, I guess, I wouldn't say it came naturally, but it's something I've been doing for a really long time. I started doing range trading when I was probably 12 or 13 years old. So my grandfather was a calculus professor, you know, mathematician, and my mom was sort of a degen day trader, I guess. So I sort of took the both of those things and came up with a little bit more responsible way of, I would say, like, taking my Tetris skills, you know, as a in terms of reactions and memory and stuff like that to put things together, and then putting that with just general fundamentals of looking for certain indicators in terms of, like, you know, what are some price ranges that these things typically kind of settle in at, and then psychologically getting into the sort of poker match to figure out who is actually trading this market and why are they trading this market, and try to look at all those layers at the same time. Bitcoin obviously gives you so much more information than you get anywhere else because of the on-chain metrics, even though it's traded all these different exchanges, it's traded all the time. And so it's a very mature market, you know, because the 12 years of Bitcoin is really like, you know, I want to say like 40 years of a traditional asset class in that regard.
Yeah. So kind of going back a bit, maybe what was your first car or first car that you were super proud of? And why'd you pick that car?
Yeah, those are two different things for sure. My first car was a Mercedes 240D manual. It was the slowest car ever. It had 68 horsepower and it was diesel. So it like literally was not fast at all. The first car I was really proud of was the first car that I bought with baseball money, which was a 1997 Porsche 911 C2S, which was had a wide body and a very special kind of like look. And they only made 753 of those for the country in 1997. So I felt like, oh, I'm getting this kind of niche product. And I drove the wheels off that thing. It was great. I had that, but that, I mean, like what a prick I was driving that while I was in the minor leagues. I literally was 22 or something and I had a 911.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny.
So in terms of like watching markets, and do you keep up today? Are you watching various markets right now? And maybe what do you think of the NFT scene?
Yeah. So those are like maybe three different questions. So I do keep up in touch with markets. I do trade a lot still. Not as much as I did last year. Just I feel like there's definitely an advantage with Bitcoin that if you're a long-term bull, if you're a long-term hodler, then the best thing that can happen is just, you know, looking at a sort of, I don't know, I guess like a geometric way of stacking. So what I try to do is I always set up limits. So if there's down, even if it's not going down, I'll still have buy orders that are, you know, 2, 5, 8, 10, 20% down below the price, just in case, you know, and that money that I'm playing with in that regard is money that I would have had in my savings account or something like that. So it might be $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that, you know, spread across these different ranges. Or if I have a liquidity event, if I sell a car, sell a guitar, sell a watch, something like that, then I'll put that money in there and just kind of have it sitting. Bitcoin's so volatile. It's sort of, you have to look at it. If you're any kind of trader person at all, you always want to buy cheap Bitcoin. That sounds kind of funny because, I mean, the thesis is that Bitcoin's going to be $1 million one day. It's all cheap. But the game of it is effectively trying to buy $50,000 Bitcoin for $44,000 or something like that. So I trade on Binance US mostly. And so there's this, like, every once in a while, they have these really weird spikes And one happened a couple, I guess it happened in November or something like that. There was a huge vertical down. I think somebody was trading and they were putting in a limit sell order for like 82,000 and they accidentally hit 8,200 and they dumped like 500 Bitcoin. And I had limits that were maybe at the time Bitcoin was sort of in the 50,000 range. And I think I had limits that were like at 30, 34, 38, in, you know, all the way down that deep. And they got picked up. I was going through the airport and it was like, you're like, all of a sudden it was like these notifications went off. And so that's, I think, a safer, more like socially responsible way to trade, which is to say that you're going to have a sort of a catch point where if Bitcoin does something and you're a buyer, you're just going to be buying it at those dips. In terms of other markets, I do try to trade on the NASDAQ and, you know, Dow Jones and stuff like that through like other accounts that I have where I'll be playing with Bitcoin companies. So like, you know, Riot or, you know, the Valkyrie Trust or the Valkyrie Bitcoin balance sheet or something like that. I'll be playing with those things. I'm a subscriber on HedgeEye. So I actually interact with them a lot on Twitter. And they're actually starting to like listen to me a little bit on some of the Bitcoin stuff, which is good because they're traders, right? And I think being a holder and a trader, two different things, but it's all this big merge. And then in regards to NFTs, my brother is actually an NFT artist. His name is Thank You X, and he does a lot of NFTs on Nifty Gateway. I'm not an NFT guy. I like art. I'm a very like passionate person in terms of like collecting art, collecting photographs, like, you know, stuff like this. I like taking photographs. So my house has a bunch of paintings that I've done, like actual oil paintings that I've done, as well as, you know, photographs that I've taken from my travels around the world. So that's what I like. I mean, I think like Salvador Dali is a great artist. He's a crazy, he's probably a total psychopath socially, but I love his art. I'm not as good as him. That's where the proof of work comes in to say that if I was super rich, I would see the value in his thing because it's rare. He's dead. There's only one of his XYZ masterwork originals, right? You know? So to me, it's very hard to make the argument for digital scarcity as a sort of viable, you know, place to put my money as a Bitcoiner. That's just like really all Bitcoin. And I used to trade a lot of alts and stuff like that. I don't do that anymore because it's so much bandwidth, so many frothy things happening. It's just been easier for me in the last, like, I would say probably 15 months to just stack and just accumulate and then try to use, you know, levers and buy and sell cards for Bitcoin and stuff like that to play the game that way. Cause it's easier for me to create. I'm not Jason Williams. I can't just like plop down for 15 Bitcoin all at once and then timestamp it on Twitter.
Right. How do you kind of think about maybe people who are interested in trading and see the NFTs as something to trade and maybe don't get Bitcoin? Is that sort of,
I would say if you want to make money in NFTs, you should just make NFTs. There's no reason to trade NFTs. Okay. Because it's like, there's a cost associated with it that could go down where there's an asymmetric upside. If you're popular, and you want to make money off it, right? You just release stuff, you know, just sell it and change the colors on the faces and change where the freckles are. And I mean, whatever it is that you're going to do. But like, for me, the whole thing with like ETH rocks and things like that, I just view that as such a cartel, you know. I really do. I'm very negative and very bearish about that whole thing. And like I said, I do have some sort of knowledge of it from just having cursory conversations. But also when you look at the Chainalysis of it, there's this really easy way because it's insider trading. So these guys were basically able, if 10 of us get $5 together, then we could basically buy something for $50 and then give each other the money back. And then we can do that 10 times. And then everybody's got $50 as a floor. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody buys something at a discount for $40 and it's really only ever $5 that the people put in. So those types of the vulnerability that people have to the narrative with NFTs, I think is the most dangerous aspect of it in that regard. And listen, people are, if they want to be adults and do it all they want, but there's a lot of money to be made trading. And I would recommend trading if you want to trade. I wouldn't say trading an NFT because an NFT in itself doesn't have liquidity the way Ethereum, you know, or any of these other altcoins does. If you want to trade, I mean, like Ethereum went down to 3,300 or down below 2,000 or something. You buy it there, you sell it at 4,000, you made money. Same thing with Bitcoin. You buy it at 36, sell it at 48, buy it back at 42, you're making money. I think a lot of people though, because of the ease of trading, meaning it's so fast that you can do it in so many different places, they don't really understand the sort of net gain, net tax loss type thing. And that's really where they need to do the math. And it's not just a game, it's math and a game at the same time. So you have to really protect yourself and say, okay, well, it's short-term capital gains. I live in California, so it's basically 50%. So for me to make 10 bucks, I've got to really make, you know, 15 bucks or something like that, 20 bucks. And that has to be a target. But like last year I was doing high frequency trading and my average trade was about $8 or $9 of a win per trade. So I made dozens of thousands of trades. So the way I made money was basically this volume of really quick, not greedy trades. You know, when you try to make, you try to get too greedy with stuff. And I think that's what's happened to a lot of people with Dogecoin and some of these other ones that they bought in at 40 cents saying, oh, it's going to go to a dollar. Now it's back at 17 cents. The people that bought it at 7 cents and sold it at 40 cents made all the money. Those are the people that made all the money with Dogecoin. And you know, I have a lot of coworkers that were sitting here and like, I even drew charts for them. I'm like, listen, I'm not gonna do this. You want to play with this? Go ahead. This is where it's going to bounce. This is where the support is. Like, go get them, Tiger. Right. You know, it's just not something I really want to spend time on.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. I think that, you know, I get the feeling that you just really enjoy the trading or watching the markets and seeing the patterns and the fractals and the trends. So we got to meet down in Dallas. We actually met online, I think, earlier over the winter in Clubhouse. And I think right before Dallas, we were in Miami. I think you were the keynote speaker at Bitcoin Day in Kansas City.
Yep.
And I've seen you on Twitter at least twice now in D.C., once with Gladstein. How'd the book come about?
Yeah, the book, man, the book itself, the assembly of the book is just as good of a story as the books end up going to end up being, I think. And I think, you know, Jimmy Song is, I think he's been in Bitcoin a really long time. And because he's been in Bitcoin a really long time, he's got this sort of casual fluency to it, right? Because you have a guy that's a core dev that also understands from a math perspective, because he was a math major in college, this sort of the macro argument really well, which as a stock trader, day trader guy, that was really my initial foray into Bitcoin was the macro argument for Bitcoin, which is that, hey, there's all this money flooding the system. The government just continually runs at a deficit. They're going to continue to print. We're going to hit trillions and trillions and trillions. It's going to keep going up. Like, where is the reset button? Where is the exit ramp from that hamster wheel that we're on? And so in 2018, when I sort of got into Bitcoin and I saw the fixed supply against the hamster wheel, and I was like, I can make one choice or the other. I'm going to go to a fixed supply door and play in that. I'm going to play in that playhouse and see what happens. And, you know, so Jimmy, basically he's written a bunch of these books. He's done coding. He's done startups. He's done all these other things. And so he put together a team, a diverse team to do a book sprint. And a book sprint is basically what it sounds like. You literally put 7 or 8 people in a room and you knock it out. And so we, like, just like we were building an app or just like we're going to go live at some other DevCon or something like that, like a hackathon, we basically took 8 people and we drew up post-it notes for what we thought was important. We said, okay, this is what we want the book to be about. And then we just talked about Bitcoin and all these different things that we felt like Bitcoin did. It empowers, you know, minority communities that have been marginalized by the traditional banking system. It empowers Main Street. It's good on the geopolitical sense because it obviously promotes freedom. There's all this like game theory behind America, China, CBDCs, authoritarianism, freedom, liberty, all those things. And then the Bitcoin voter, right? So the thing that we've been talking about lately, as we've seen people so dissatisfied with the results of elections, perhaps we need to elect people based on different traits altogether. One of those things would be, do they get Bitcoin? Because if you get Bitcoin, there's the sort of a package deal, right? You tend to have a little bit more of a logical base as opposed to emotionally flying off the handle, although there is rage quitting, of course. So there's this thing that you're looking at in a Bitcoin politician or a Bitcoin voter that it sort of matches with Bitcoin itself, which is to say that you're looking for freedom, you're looking for accountability, which is a big deal that we don't see in a lot of politicians. And, you know, and that kind of combination led a lot of people to saying, hey, why don't we start talking to DC about this proactively? That's really how Jimmy and I got closer, was through the nonprofit, which is the Bitcoin Today Coalition. So the authors for the book were Lamar Wilson, Charlene Federipo, Pete Rizzo, Gary Leland, Annalise Witterspoon, Amanda Cavallari, Jimmy Song, and myself. And you know, we had males, females, different age ranges, different experiences, different business backgrounds, different time in Bitcoin, which I think was also one of the things that we didn't really talk about was this. If everybody had been in Bitcoin since 2012, then there wouldn't be much diversity with opinion because people would have sort of come into the same thing. And anyway, so the book, basically, we did post-its on Monday night after barbecue. Just this is, if you're dealing with Jimmy, you're dealing with barbecue. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we're in Austin, we rent an Airbnb, everyone's in there. We do post-it notes. We break the post-it notes into like subject matter. And then we sort of split them around the room. And then we start naming chapters at that point. So by Monday night at about midnight is when we sort of, disbanded. And we had 8 or 9 chapters. We had topics. We had some post-it notes. We had some stuff. And we basically built the entire book in Google Drive. And then we would sort of go into different. So it was like, okay, said, you're going to take this chapter. CJ, you take this one. You know, you take that one. And so everybody took a chapter and did like a first pass, putting some stuff together. And then we did then we switched. And then, so it's like, and then once I left chapter 7, I moved on to chapter 2, and I moved on to chapter 5, then I moved on to chapter 6, then moved to chapter 1. So like everybody did a little bit of everything. And then we would reconvene every couple hours. The next day we got to the point where by, I want to say it was either Tuesday night or Wednesday night, we literally put a draft out for reviewers, and it got pretty eviscerated, I guess, by some people, because we hadn't really even edited it yet. We were just trying to get a bunch of mush on the wall and just, you know, put it all, mush it onto the wall. And then it was, and that was a weird process, but to basically say, okay, we haven't had a chance to really edit this for much of anything. Like, right. don't kill us. And then we have a Telegram group. And then we had about, I'd say 20 people took a look at it, and we had some really, really good, I would say like industry people, people that work for companies like Cash App, and people that are like working on Capitol Hill as a lobbyist, or, you know, we had some think tank people and stuff like that are sort of politically adjacent. And then we just had some Bitcoiners and podcasters and just people that we know. And the feedback that we got, the initial feedback was really interesting. It was like, hey, are you trying to write a book for the left and the right at the same time? And I was like, yes. And they're like, how the hell are you going to do that? Like, these people, you can't even use the same language, right? They like different words, stuff like that. We're like, that's okay. And I got to the point where I was talking to Jimmy about it, and he said something, and he was like, you know what? Let them talk. If they read it, they read it. You know what I mean?
Right.
He's like, if someone doesn't like it, they read it. You know what I mean? And I was kind of like, Yeah. Like, we don't have to make friends with this. We just have to tell the truth. And then it was like this, like, all of a sudden, I think once everybody sort of absorbed that, that was really difficult, because you want to be received well, right? And then, but with Bitcoin, you have to have this willingness to sort of like stand there naked and be like, hey, this is what it is. Like, this is the truth of Bitcoin. Take it or leave it. Yeah. If you have a problem with this, it's not for you. Like, enjoy, like, have fun staying poor, right? So having that American HODL voice in the back of my head a little bit, it was like, hey, basically, like, we're going to write a thing. This was, you know, we're going to write a thing. It's going to say some stuff. If you don't like it, maybe there's a reason why you're offended by it. Right. And so, you know, on a political side or on a Bitcoin side, because we live in America, all of us live in America. So we have to promote Bitcoin as an American thing. And we want American politicians to adopt Bitcoin, because they'll be nicer to Bitcoin people at that point, which means we'll have a higher quality of life and not have to live in a woods, not have to live in the woods in a Faraday cage.
Right. Yeah. I read both of Jimmy's prior book sprint projects, and I always wondered how hard it was to take all many voices and make it sound like one. I'm assuming that you could probably do impressions of everyone's voice, but was it a challenge making the book sound like it came from one voice?
Well, so it's funny, because there's certain things, like every strengths that people have, right? Like, I like to tell jokes. So I like to use alliteration and stuff like that. Jimmy likes to use alliteration. Pete likes to use the Oxford comma. Lamar likes to have this sort of, Lamar's dad was a preacher. So he's got like this, he's like we got into this whole thing. And this is one of the funniest moments. There's 8 of us. We're sitting there. Like, we have the book on a TV, right? Or like hooked up to a monitor. Everyone's on their laptops. And Lamar says something, and he's like, come on, man, haven't you ever tried, like, when you're waking up from a dream, to hold on to that dream? And we're all like, what the hell is he talking about? You know? It was so funny. We started dying laughing. But the thing that we got through was to say that in order to avoid the word salad trapdoor landmine that so many Bitcoiners fall into, we had Gary Leland, aka the Bitcoin Boomer, read and that was the guy that we tried to deliver the message to, because we're like, hey, this guy is over 55 years old, right? Clearly, he is a closer profile to the politician, regardless of Democrat, Republican, right? Just in terms of jargon, just in terms of like overall absorption for different words, he's not going to want to go through this sort of, you know, metaphysical, like Bitcoin is love and all this other stuff. And I'm using my hands to do like, I don't know, whatever this dance is right now. He didn't, that's not Gary, right? So he was kind of the ultimate filter when it came down to word choices to say, okay, is this a word Gary would use and Gary would say? So the hard thing is when you have eight people, which like I said, demographically different, geographically different, politically different, all of us have our own takes on things. I got really dug in on certain things because I said, listen, this is a specific word that has the meaning of a lot of different words. We need to use this word. And this is an important word. And they were like, oh, but that might trigger some people or whatever. I was like, fuck it. Like, that's what we have to do. Right. And so there's stuff there where you're going to lose battles when it's 1-on-7 sometimes, but it's good to take a stand because then it forces everybody to evolve that sentence. But we went line by line through the whole book, you know, chapter by chapter, starting at the front, ending at the back, getting to the point where we felt like those sentences made sense. We tried to eliminate as much as possible, which was so weird to delete so much stuff. The book could have been twice as long. Right. And that was the strangest thing, was that book could have been 200 pages. It's probably going to end up being like 95 or 100 pages, which is great because that's really the attention span of a DC staffer, which is essentially that's the audience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting how, yeah, I like the 1-7 and then gaining consensus from that perspective. I think it really pushes people. What kind of ideas came out during the Main Street part?
Yeah, so the Main Street thing, I think, is very important because that's where we're talking about small businesses using Bitcoin. One of the biggest problems that we have in America is the asymmetry between big and small businesses. And the perfect example of that was during COVID. Some businesses were deemed unessential and then forced to close, or they could stay open, but you know, under potential penalty of massive fines and jail time for the owner or something like that. So a great example of that is payments. So what a lot of people don't understand is the convenience of using a Visa or Amex means that you're actually spending 2-4% of the receiver's money. Because like at my car dealership, if someone buys 4 tires, it's $1,200. They swipe their Amex. I've got to pay $48 to Amex to run that transaction. So if you think about that in terms of Bitcoin, and to use a little bit of a Michael Saylor voice, Bitcoin really has an advantage because you're able to, frankly, disintermediate the process from the vendor. So you have this thing where there's no tactical advantage for me to use Amex as a business, right? Other than, like, to say that, oh, more people have Amexes, right, or whatever. If I add that up for every 30, 40, 50 bucks that I'm losing on aggregate basis over the course of the year, I do thousands of those types of transactions in that type of size. Right. And I'm just one guy running a couple car dealerships, right? We have 100 something employees. We do a little bit over 150 million in revenue. But if a big percentage of that is like our service department, you know, and those swipe fees, it's maybe 30, 40 million of revenue. Now that's not profit, but that's me, but that's gross revenue that I'm losing. And so if you convert that gross revenue that you lose, which is 2-4% into gain from net revenue, because it's effectively, there's no product involved in that, right? That's a massive swing for a low margin, high volume business. And that's the majority of businesses. The majority of businesses are paying the vendor, which is to say the credit card merchant, before they receive anything, which is wild because they're having to either price their stuff higher to account for that, or which effectively makes more money for Visa and MasterCard, right? Because you raise your prices, they're the ones collecting right, the 2-4%. So it's really like this weird cycle that they've developed this oligopoly of payments, and that screws Main Street, like, frankly. So while they're trying to ban cash and do all this other stuff, it's like Bitcoin's basically like, just pick up your phone and go, boop. And then you like QR code it. And now all of a sudden you're paying using Cash App, Strike, or something like that. It's a much better situation. And so we're looking internally, we're talking to vendors like Strike, because they have an API or Cash App or anybody else, to see if we can do that. So the chapter deals with that, deals with companies like Tahini's. I mean, we had a whole thing in there about Tahini's, about how they're taking Bitcoin And then once they have their operating account kind of covered, they just hold the rest of it in Bitcoin, because why not? Because Bitcoin's the only strategic asset that you can have that actually scales, right? Like CDs or any other bank instrument, basically, you get more interest if you have more money. So if you have less money, you get no interest.
Right.
And that kind of wave, you know, really flattens out with Bitcoin. And that's one of the things we really try to emphasize, to say that, hey, if you're a small business, like, this is really good for you if you get on board with it. And it's liquid. So if you do need money, you can always draw against your Bitcoin. You can sell your Bitcoin 24/7. You know, you can cash out if you have to pay a bill using that. But it really is this sort of circular economy for Main Street if they do that. And it's better for the people. It's better for the business. You know, the only people that hurts are the people that aren't there. And the people that aren't there are the payment processors, because they're literally, you know, in some ivory tower in some other area.
Right. Well, I think, yeah, all that I think is really interesting. And I think to dig a little bit more into sort of Main Street, or maybe even the Rust Belt, but I want to put that with your interest with mining. So mm-hmm. I think I saw you tweet, you're mining at home, maybe. You mentioned earlier that you've been visiting some places around the country. I think actually, when I was in Dallas, I ran into Adam O from Upstream mm-hmm. Data. And he's like, yeah, I ran into CJ in Houston at the Bit Devs mm-hmm. meeting. And so I saw the mining connection there. And this was before I saw the politics come in. But so what kind of made you take up mining? How's the mining at home going? And how do you see that maybe benefiting the Rust Belt?
Yeah. So in California, mining at home sucks. I had somebody ask me today if they thought mining at home was a good idea in California. I said, listen, unless you're trying to heat up your jacuzzi or something and use the ASICs as heat, it's not a really good idea, because we're paying 35 to 42 cents per kilowatt hour for power here. So unless you're on like some crazy oversolared with the battery system, right, you might be able to run one new gen miner, like one what's miner 31 M31 plus or something like that, or one S19. But realistically, if you're running anything past like a couple S9s, you're probably, you know, spending so much of electricity that you might as well just be buying the dips with Bitcoin. So there's companies like Compass Mining, and River is now doing co-location mm-hmm. services as well. So I have a couple miners set up at those places. But then I also have I'm mining with another Bitcoin guy on an oil patch in Texas. So we have a digital shovel unit and an Upstream Data unit, and we're basically, you know, like running these miners off of excess natural gas. So it's a great conversation starter when I'm talking to some of these Rust Belt states on the DC side, because I'm saying, hey guys, listen, like, you guys have this energy there. It's just burning. It's just flaring right now. You should be pushing incentives to bring miners to your state, because those people that are mining in that state, they're going to buy stuff in your state, which means they pay sales tax. They're going to be flying to your state to visit, which means they have employees. They're going to have, you know, there's going to be payroll taxes and all these things. So trying to like mainstream it as an industry to the lawmakers has been a really big pitch for us. And I think for me personally, it's one of the easiest things for me to explain, which is to say, hey, China gifted us hash rate, right? They gifted us this hash rate dominance, meaning America. We need to take advantage of that. And if you're a state like Pennsylvania, Nebraska, Kansas, whatever, you might be a purple state. It might not even be a red state or a blue state. But then if you can make mining like a thing as a politician that you're pushing forward the way Wyoming and Texas has, I mean, it's just going to be huge. And so, yeah, mining for me is a big deal. I think it's the one thing that as an American person, you know, you can participate in the Bitcoin network in like a really productive way. You end up getting Bitcoin cheaper by doing it this way. You don't get as much Bitcoin up front because it's like basically you're getting a little bit at a time, but it really is a coaching thing for low time preference. Although it is addictive to look at your, you know, S19s on Slushpool and see that they're cranking out. But you know, like we had a setback the other day, like the patch I'm on, the guy that owns it was basically like, hey, I'm starting to sell my natural gas for more expensive. Like, you guys need to move. So we literally need to move to another place. So there's like ups and downs with that. But there's some huge companies that are revitalizing the Rust Belt, and that's the story. So you have Riot specifically, which is the story I know the best of, and it probably gets told the most, but it's a great example for lawmakers, which is to say that an old Alcoa aluminum smelting plant basically went defunct. And as a result, the town around it had no real core industry anymore. So Riot and some other like technical partners basically have built out this massive multi-megawatt facility, and, you know, hundreds of megawatts. And they're running an immersion cooling system there on the whole place. So that's rad. And so the technical innovation, the sort of American sort of technical innovators and the sort of wildcat oil dudes and stuff like that, that are like, you know, Jed Clampett's or whatever with more sophisticated tools. I mean, these people have a chance to really change the industry around. And at the end of the day, it's not about oil in the sense that you're sitting there saying like, oh, you know, it's anti, I don't know, emissions or something like that. Cause it actually isn't. When you mine using flare gas, what you're doing is you're taking CH4 methane that would normally go into the atmosphere and be like way worse in terms of hundreds of percent worse in terms of the heating capability and the heat retention of that methane molecule versus carbon dioxide. And you're actually burning that through an engine, just like a car engine, or, I mean, they have actual, like the really big ones are turbines. So you'll have like a GE, like a 737 engine on a trailer. And there's a guy out of Houston that does that named Eric that I actually ironically played minor league baseball with. So I set him up with Parker and the Unchained guys. And so he's going to these bit devs meetups and meeting people, and he's going to be doing some mining and stuff as well. But he was just doing it because they were basically doing electric fracking. And so they were taking the nat gas and turning into electricity so they could frack. And so it's basically kind of like the Native American style of like using every bit of the buffalo, right? So in this sense, you can basically take one of these data centers and plug it in to the middle of nowhere, run a cell tower on it, and then mine Bitcoin. And it's a great way to acquire Bitcoin. And I feel like I'm securing the network and I'm participating and stuff like that. So it's, for me, that's better than, and it's approachable because as you get revenue, you can buy more miners and you can scale up, which I think is the, just like commercial real estate or farming, except you can't participate on either of those for like $10,000 the way you can buy an S19 and just kind of go for it.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I'm kind of curious, going back to the politics. Are you guys thinking about 2022 and 2024 races? Is that, and what is the thoughts there and maybe the approach or the goals, or I don't know how to phrase it, but.
Yeah. I mean, so there's it's a multifaceted thing. Like when people talk about politics, that, you know, there's the mayor of your local city, which in term Bitcoin terms, we have Suarez, we have Eric Adams from New York saying he's going to take 3 paychecks. We got the Tampa mayor going to take paychecks in Bitcoin. So you have Bitcoin mayors, right?
Right.
Now you have Bitcoin senators, you got Lummis, you got Bitcoin congressmen, you got Warren Davidson, using these as examples that a lot of people have probably heard of. So, you know, I think what it comes down to is like, there's also Bitcoin candidates, right? So in Sherman Oaks, California, Erica Rhodes is running against Brad Sherman. Erica Rhodes is a school teacher. She's a Democrat. She's progressive. She's all this other stuff, which is, you know, really unique, I would say, for a race of this caliber. And she is running against an incumbent that's been there dug in for 15 years or 20 years, right, or something like that. Brad is the number one like anti-Bitcoin dude in Congress from, you know, and then maybe Elizabeth Warren is the number one anti-Bitcoin person in the Senate.
Right.
And she's running against that guy. So it's like a national thing for Bitcoiners to support Erica Rhodes. So, you know, so in her sense, yes, she's running. There's a primary in summer 22. So like on a personal level, you know, I've donated to her campaign and stuff like that. I'm happy to say that. Happy to admit that. I've retweeted a bunch of her stuff. So it's probably not a big leap of logic. But then, you know, in other cases, as our nonprofit is geared towards sitting lawmakers, sitting legislators. So we're just talking to people that are already there, that are in DC, you know, talking to them about their policies, maybe what their state needs. There's some states that aren't really like, quote, Bitcoin states yet, the way Wyoming and Texas are, that really could be, letting the cat out of the bag early. But like states that basically, I'll just give you a matrix of who those could be: flyover states, purple states, energy rich, low density of people, infrastructure poor, you know, like living off a lot of government assistance. Those states can all really benefit from Bitcoin. Cold weather states, states with water, states that are willing to have a nuclear plant, anywhere energy is basically less than 11 cents residential. Those people should all those states should be mining Bitcoin. And if you have a state that could mine Bitcoin, why would you not want it to, right? Why would you not want your citizens to be wealthier? Why wouldn't you want your industries to be stronger, more robust? Why wouldn't you want the merging of those two things happening at the same time? And, you know, like when we first started the C4, the thing that I think caught on was, I don't know, you know, you're like in a group and everyone's talking and I blurted out, America should be the best place to be a Bitcoiner. And everyone's like, that's pretty good. Let's build around that. And that's kind of the fundamental thing that's my lens, that's my lane, you know. And are we making America you know, more aligned with Bitcoin, Bitcoin more aligned with America? Can we merge those things to make the politics of what we're experiencing here more livable for more people? And whether that's, you know, low income or, you know, high tech innovators, it's really everybody can benefit, you know. So how do we get Bitcoin in the hands of more people? Because if we have 30, 40, 50 million Bitcoiners, maybe we have 100 million Bitcoiners at some point in America. Yeah. Will that swing the race in 2024? 100%, you know, and will the country be better off? That's the real question. Will the country be better off if you have 100 million Bitcoiners voting for the same person? You know, or on local levels, voting for the same people, you know, in various layers of government.
Yeah. I kind of wonder, what would you say to maybe the Bitcoiners who are like, no one should deal with politics at all. You know, it's not worth our time or something like that. And you're putting so much time in it. What would be sort of your counter or response to that?
That was a reaction very, very early. And I heard, so Adam, frankly, Denver Bitcoin was on a podcast with Stefan Lavera. And Stefan Lavera asked him that very question. And he goes, I've never met anybody that makes me like really think that a Bitcoiner should be talking about politics or I should care about politics. A lot of, you know, da, 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 da. And I was kind of like driving, listening to that. I was like, I think I owe this guy a text message, right? So the thing that I thought about, because every layer, every era of Bitcoin is populated with a different theme, right? And so these themes don't necessarily fade, but they sort of get usurped by the next thing, right? So in the early phase pre-halvening, like 09 to 2011, 2012, you know, everybody was like, they're mining Bitcoin and they're using Bitcoin and they're like, hey, we're doing this. No one's going to know about it. It's going to be a secret. It's our secret. You know, it's very closed in that regard. And I think there might've been like a sort of, there might've been a little bit of a punk rock thing to say, hey, we're looking to push this thing to see how far we can take it. Not necessarily because we think it's going to turn to something different. It's not going to morph, but right. Just like how far can we spread it and keep it original, you know, keep that vibe. And then I think what happened was enough people found out about it through the sort of traditional finance sense that it became a speculative asset, you know, during the halving process from maybe 2012 to 2015. And then because it became a national news story with Mt. Gox and with Silk Road and stuff like that, then there became this sort of this dark side to it where people started associating this sort of darkness to Bitcoin. Cause I don't think that was there initially. I don't think anybody felt like that was the thing. So just like any other, you know, Jedi or whatever skill, you know, yin and yang, which is the way I look at things, you see this rise come up where people are suddenly financially free to do these things and they're able to buy these things, whether it's pizzas or whatever. But then suddenly someone's like, wow, it's totally free. We can do anything with it. Now it's anarchy. And now we can order hits and buy drugs and get hookers and like whatever else. So then that became an outsized story to the original people were like, do whatever you want with it, but like, let's not make it about anything, you know, like let's keep it just about the tech, about the safety, the security, you know, the sort of cypherpunk thing. And then, you know, eventually then you get the full on degen speculators with the next cycle, which was the 17 rip to 20,000. Then you're getting traditional Wall Street bros. You're getting, you know, kids, you're getting video gamers, because it was like being given away as a prize at video game tournaments and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was like there's people that were selling things for Bitcoin, like digital goods for Bitcoin, because it was the only way you could do traditional commerce through like embargoed countries or whatever else. Right. Like if you wanted to sell something to somebody in Belarus, you kind of had to use Bitcoin because they can't take dollars. It's, you know, whatever. So, and then I think this cycle, the sort of 2019, 2020, you know, increase has been all about the macro. It's been all about the world is going to hell. We have to figure this out. The money is a massive problem and we need to fix the money, you know, because the money supply is drunk and it's going all kinds of crazy directions. It just Xerox its butt cheeks at the holiday party. You know, that's so. The money supply has been going nuts. So that's maybe this generation. That's where you're seeing the people that are taking the sort of the Preston Pish, you know, macro analysis, as opposed to maybe the maximalist anti-establishment, you know, Svetsky thing from like maybe the previous cycle or the cycle before that or whatever. So depending on what time you got in, it's none of those things have gone away. You just, because the pie keeps getting bigger, there's more entrants. Right. So you have more people with fresh takes. It's just like a bell curve. you have someone like me that's like, oh, I can trade it 24 hours a day, which is my initial thing, right? Then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, this is freedom of speech. Like this is perfect because it's like, I can hand it to my kids. I can do this. I can do that. And this education and lifelong inspiration, the GG down the rabbit hole book, the sort of meditative Tomer Strohlite, you know, these things that are sort of, I would say, growing in influence. And then you have Jimmy, who's sort of been this thread along the whole way. Pete Rizzo, who's been a historian the whole way. Jameson Lopp, who's been in it for a super long time. Adam Back. But you see these people kind of come in and out, whereas like Max Kaiser is like super popular right now because he's sensationalistic. He's saying the exact same stuff he said 10 years ago, you know, or 12 years ago, but he's saying it now with a massive audience because people are clamoring for that information. And we can like download and, I don't know, binge watch Bitcoin content now that didn't used to exist. It used to be Anthopoulos on a stage with like 13 people in the room explaining right. how Bitcoin worked using like the white paper diagrams. And that's not really, that's not the same thing that's going to be used, you know, 3 years from now. Right. Those now, which is to say that everybody contributes to Bitcoin because every time you do a transaction, you're putting one more piece of wood and nail into the arc. Right? Because you're solidifying each transaction on the blockchain, you're solidifying the entire network and the history of the network and running a node and all these other things. And when you see people like Elon Musk say, oh, regular people aren't going to run a node, it's like, it's not that hard. You just download it and then you run it. It's that's it, right? And you can do transactions through that. Now they have coin joins and whirlpools and all these other things. So the innovation is just going to keep churning, but there's going to be these people fail, these people rage quit. You know, you're going to see people turn and turn into shitcoiners or whatever, whatever it is. But you're also going to see new innovators. You're going to see Jack Maulers, right? Come up with a product. You're going to see Jack Dorsey decide, nope, Bitcoin only the rest of my life. I'm doing Bitcoin. And, you know, that type of stuff from these big billionaire people effectively is just as cool as the guy that was like, hey man, just buy like a dollar worth of Bitcoin. There's the one dude that, I don't know. I forget his name, but he's got like a YouTube video from like 9 years ago where he's telling people to buy like 10 bucks worth of Bitcoin or something like that. And he posted a video recently where he's like on a yacht with a bunch of people. And he's like, told you, you know? That's so funny. It's led to a lot of people winning, you know, overall. And which is the whole point really. And so, but those cycles, there's going to be another cycle. There's going to be a flat line or a bear market or whatever, potentially. It can't all be super cycle. You know, Right. We haven't hit 200,000 yet, so it's not going to get there tomorrow. It could get there. It's Bitcoin's kind of quantum in that sense. It could go to 20, then it could go to 200. It could go to 200, then it could go to 20. You do anything. And that's, I think, what I like about it so much. But my goal is like, okay, 10 years from now, how much Bitcoin can I have under my belt? You know, not so much what's it worth, but how much can I have? Because I know at some point it will go, you know, where I think it's going to go.
Yeah. But I really enjoyed what you said there. And I'm really curious with the way you kind of look at markets and numbers and your proximity to this particular market. What are you seeing with like cars and used cars and inflation?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, dude, inflation is so real and so tangible that there's no denying it. And the Bitcoin lens, when you put those sunglasses on, you put those orange lenses on and you look through them and you say, okay, they're telling me this thing. The government, the media, right. You know, CNN, whatever, they're saying this thing. I'm going to call bullshit on that. I'm going to do research on that. I'm going to see number one bullshitter, this guy, right? You're going to see if they're telling you the truth. And when you see these graphs of the money supply going straight vertical and they're printing trillions of dollars, let me take a more mature tactic. They're putting trillions of dollars into circulation. Right? Regardless of if they're using that through treasuries or debt or actual liquidity injections or whatever, there's all these financial instruments that are basically absorbing trillions of dollars. So of course, goods and services, especially goods with a fixed supply, are going to go up. And that's used cars. That's new cars. There's a limit to how many things you can build, how many Rolexes you can build or whatever. They can't, because you have to be skilled. That's proof of work again. In order to be like there's only so many Hattori Hanzo samurai swords that you can get, right? That's sort of the reference there from Pulp Fiction. Kill Bill, right? So in that regard, you know, yeah, the used car market has been insane. We've seen cars go for 20 to 30% more than they really should be going for. And so when the CPI numbers come out and you see 3, 4, 5% get reported, you're like, you know that's not true, right? You go to your favorite burger place and your burger, your number one is now $9. Whereas when we were kids, it was three something, right? Or $2.99 or whatever for a number one. I don't care what your number one was, like, but that's what it was. You don't have the 99 cent anything anymore, right? So it's not that the utility of that thing suddenly evaporated and it's no good. It's just that the money is worse because there's so much more of it that it's easier for some people to get, which means that they can overspend because they don't actually care how much they're spending. And that's like the psychology of the economy that some of these economists like Paul Krugman, they don't actually acknowledge, which makes them inherently disingenuous because they're sitting there saying, oh, it doesn't hurt low income people to have inflation. It's like, dude, they make 10 bucks or 12 or 15 bucks an hour or whatever. Like their wages are fixed. They have no commission. They have no 401k if they're making 15 bucks an hour, right? So as gas gets more expensive, it's a higher percentage of their monthly costs. It's a higher percentage of their budget. And if they suddenly get kicked out of their lease because they have an entrepreneurial landlord that wants to get a heavier price tag in there, then they have to go somewhere else. They're also going to pay more, or they're going to have worse living conditions. So that's really the trade-off that like is bright and clear as day that people can see that that's happening. And when they don't acknowledge that, you know, that's, and Bitcoiners have seen that and called bullshit on it the entire way through. We're like, hey, this vax thing, they're going to make everybody do this. They're going to make everybody do that. They're going to make everybody do this, everybody do that. And you see these things ahead of time because when you have a super low time preference, you plan like an elephant. You plan 20, 30 years in advance because when you do have a baby, it's going to be 300 pounds. So you want to make sure you're in a nice place to drop that thing when it comes out. And that's the way Bitcoiners look at their future. They're like, hey, I need a plan for my child's inheritance. And they're like, yeah, but you only have one Bitcoin. And it's like, yeah, but one Bitcoin is going to be $1 million. And then if it's $1 million, what happens if the government drops the inheritance thing so that you can't, you know, there's this whole thing about that. So there's all these things that you have to plan for because Bitcoiners start planning 20 years in advance, which is way further than most of them ever thought before. And that's where I would say that the Bitcoin lens against the day trader Robin Hood guy, you know, there's a big conflict there. And that's why a lot of people that are quote day traders end up just being crypto dudes, which is to say that's a demotion from being a maximalist or a Bitcoiner. Because you have like in the tier of seriousness, okay, you have the totem of seriousness, you have maximalist, you know, on the top, which is they're never going to bend for anything. And, you know, I would put the guys up there that are just saying like, oh, every transaction should be a coin join. They're like the paranoid guys. They're the ones that are really thinking 20 years in advance. Then you have the Bitcoiners, which are people like me, which are basically trying to integrate Bitcoin into their business. And they're basically like converting some of their treasury into Bitcoin and like setting up Bitcoin IRAs and things like that. They're sort of like still in the matrix of the regular system, but they're Bitcoining in that regard. Then you have crypto dudes, which are basically like, yo, whatever I can do to make money, like Raoul Pi or whatever, you know, like Raoul Paul, those people are just out to make money because they still care about dollars. But when you become a Bitcoiner, you know, which is a term that some people might not even like, then you cease to need dollars on an emotional level. You cease to value dollars because you're like, well, I mean, like unless Bitcoin goes down, what good do these dollars do me? And because right. When Bitcoin goes down, I just buy and I get more Bitcoin for that. Because like, I would rather just live my life on a total Bitcoin standard because it really is the better money. And the downside of that is, you know, that whatever you spend in Bitcoin today will eventually look like an overspend. But right. At the same time, just imagine not buying Bitcoin and buying fiat stuff that devalues at the same time, then, you know, that's even a bigger kick in the nuts. And I've experienced that emotional beatdown thousands of times as I think about all the cool fancy cars that I bought in 2013 and 2014, mm-hmm. when I had heard about Bitcoin, but had never met a Bitcoiner. And I decided to buy cool cars instead of, you know, buying any Bitcoin at all, you know? So I think about that and that keeps me up at night, but it's fine. I mean, everybody has to learn that lesson at some point. And it allowed me to, once I got into Bitcoin, to dive as deep as possible really fast. And I think that's where I got into it. But until I started meeting other Bitcoin people, I was super uncomfortable tweeting about Bitcoin. I didn't know any of these people who they were, other than what I read about in terms of the Adam Back, you know, type Satoshi. I knew about that stuff, but I didn't know who American HODL was or Svetsky or any of these other guys that I enjoy their stuff now or enjoy their presence now. because there was nobody talking right. about them. So through Clubhouse and Twitter and stuff, now it's like, now I'm letting the flag out. I'm like, okay, orange flag, just fly in the wind, whatever. I don't care who knows I'm a Bitcoiner.
Yeah. Hey, it's very interesting being a Bitcoiner. I think you mentioned some things about like I look at my sports collectibles from a kid growing up and my baseball cards, and I'm really starting to itch. Like, I just want to sell them all and turn them all into Bitcoin. And I've kind of done little projects like that in the past. When I first got into Bitcoin, I sold some stuff for Bitcoin because I was like, all right, if we can't use this money, I'll get this money out of my own stuff and I'll figure it out and go there. I do want to turn to sports for a little bit just because I think got caught in a Russian doll kind of moment. Enes Kanter made a tweet kind of calling out Nike and for different things. He said, you know, how about I book plane tickets for us and let's fly to China together. We can try to visit these slave labor camps and you can see it with your own eyes. And he called out LeBron and the chairman of Nike. And I wrote, whoa. And you wrote the gas pedals all the way down. And Enes is driving the truck through the hypocrite building. So yeah. Could you elaborate on that?
Because I think the NBA is one of the most hypocritical sports bodies other than the NCAA. The NCAA is the worst. They basically break young people down and churn them out and make millions of dollars. And those kids are left with nothing. And in most cases, heavy medical bills later in their life. So Enes Kanter is calling bullshit on Nike. He's calling bullshit on the NBA. Okay. Now he is an NBA player, right? So it's interesting to see a player take the stand as an active player, right. You know, to say, hey, there is an injustice and I'm going to call it out. So he's driving the bus and he's aiming right at the hypocritical NBA Nike sort of marriage to say that, like, hey, you know, anytime someone says some bullshit, like, oh, Taiwan's not its own country or something like that, like, because somebody from China says, you can't say that, you have to acknowledge that China owns Taipei or something like that, whatever, like the John Cena thing. LeBron is always talking about civil rights. Mm-hmm. LeBron is always talking about equality and all this other stuff. Well, guess what, bro? Guess what, Bron? There's tons of people that are in internment camps, forced labor, and all that stuff. And here's a guy that's playing your sport, that knows your struggles as an athlete. Here's a guy that's from Turkey, right, that knows. Mm-hmm. He knows how crazy it is in other parts of the world because he's been there. Unlike LeBron, who's effectively a billionaire at this point. You could call it, he's close enough that he's a billionaire. He's a billion-dollar enterprise, right? Producing his own films and all this other stuff, right? So it's like, hey, don't sit here and tell me and virtue signal that this guy's a bad guy, that guy's a bad guy, this guy's a bad guy, and then not call out China, right? That's so hypocritical. And it's, as a sport, China really spends a lot of money on the NBA, right? Much more than they do on baseball. I mean, you know, so maybe that's really because I've never received sort of like what's called Chinese support. So I don't know what that's like, you know, in the same sense. The companies that I work with are German companies. That's like, you know, traditionally like a little bit more of a NATO ally for us than China is. And you know, at the end of the day, every country has a bad history, you know, of doing bad things and oppressing people. But this is happening now in China, right? This is happening right now. Right. And so when you have a guy like Enes Kanter, who's not a superstar player, he's not a, you know, he's not a perennial all-star. He's not a Hall of Fame slam dunk guy, you know, the way LeBron is. So it's like, LeBron, you have the platform more than anybody. You want to do something. Here's your chance. Do it. You know, LeBron's done so much, sending kids to school and all these other things. But then the question is, you know, it's like this, like ripping Abraham Lincoln's name off of school in the Bay Area because he didn't do enough for Native American people because he only like broke slavery, but not like the, right, you know, the Native American thing. So it's like, oh, okay, well, where do we draw the line, right? Is suddenly LeBron's legacy going to be tainted because he was called out and didn't respond? You know, what about Steph Curry or any of these other guys, you know? Is there a boycott against Nike because they build shoes in China, but maybe not another country because they build shoes in the Philippines, you know? So like but the point is the conversation, it's like, damn, this dude put the gas pedal down. Like he doesn't care what happens. He doesn't care. Like that's like, he could take an elbow in the head in the paint.
So you're saying he's being courageous.
Yes. I'm saying he's being courageous. I'm saying LeBron is a hypocrite and the NBA is a hypocrite. because that's where he's driving the bus into the building of hypocrites. You know what I mean? Like that's the action.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I grew up, prior to my time, but kind of the stories of Muhammad Ali and sort of, him standing up for issues and being very courageous. And when LeBron first came onto the scene, I saw him kind of in that mold. I no longer see that clearly with the China issue. And I do think I don't mind if someone uses their pedestal. But I just think that like you kind of have to be consistent if you're going to speak on issues and see 360. And that's a hard thing to do. But
it's hard. It's very hard to have a backbone in the face of money. But that's the whole point of human corruptibility. And that's the biggest problem that we have today in society, is that the people that stand to benefit from injustice keep benefiting from injustice, and they don't stop it because they're benefiting. And so if you have this incentive to shush, you know what I mean? Then you just keep your mouth shut and you just kind of stay like this. And that's one of the things that Bitcoiners, I think, see as like in politics, and they see that as like a historical problem with politics. And they see the whole realm of politics in that regard. Whereas like as a non-political person, I would say the reason why I want to get involved in politics is to say, hey, we can actually put Bitcoiners into these positions. We can replace these people replace the Brad Shermans with these other people. And the world will be a better place with Bitcoin people as opposed to non-Bitcoin people in that regard. And that's the way I see it, to sort of tie the bow around that whole thing. But yeah, if you're going to call bullshit on one thing, you should probably call bullshit on everything, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or you're going to get called out.
Yeah. I guess my final question, with sports season, I've really tuned out. Just, I think it's gotten over politicized. And I like when people say what they believe in, though. So I'm not offended by individuals. I just think the atmosphere has gotten over politicized. And I just had a moment where I was thinking about, I think someone tweeted about the Michael Jordan flu game. And remember, I mean, he played in the finals, I think, with the flu against, maybe it was Cleveland, and scored like 63 points. And I don't know if that was a game where he had like six threes, but I guess that can't happen today. And we saw it as like a courageous moment, something to be applauded. And it's very different times now. And I wonder, do you keep up at all with current sports, with the baseball lockout and things like that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I keep up with Formula One, the NBA a little bit. I'm a Lakers fan. You know, I grew up watching the Lakers, but I'm distancing myself like more and more from the NBA in a lot of ways. It's just something that, like, living where I live, I don't really have exposure to it as much. I don't watch football at all. So it's pretty much just baseball and racing. You know, that's kind of, those are the two things I like to do. But the lockout's really interesting right now. You know, when I was a player, I was on the negotiating committee. So I was like our team representative, and I would negotiate against the owners in these labor disputes and stuff like that before they would happen most of the time. And I would say that, 90% of the stuff that gets talked about in the labor conversations is money related, if not directly money. And what I mean by that is, like, baseball has a much different like revenue centralization model than the NFL does. So to talk about that for a second. So there's, 30 plus teams in the NFL, and 80% of their revenue gets pooled and redistributed. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Jacksonville, which is a smaller city than San Francisco or New York or whatever, or Chicago, you don't have to make as much money, and you can still receive a certain amount of money. And so you can still put a competitive or non-competitive product in the field. Baseball is the opposite. It's only 20% of the revenue centralized. So you really see this incentive for teams to be profitable through winning, which forces them to evolve in a really interesting way, because you have teams like the Astros, the Cardinals, the Braves that would be like more secondary markets in a lot of ways from New York or LA or Philadelphia or San Francisco. And as a result of that, you have these different revenue models, different player development models and all that stuff. Whereas the NFL is pretty much homogenized as a result of spreading all the money around. That being said, baseball tends to be a better sport because it's more unpredictable, because you don't really know who's going to win year in, year out. You know that there's going to be good teams in like dynastic, like championship of like the league, but not world championship, because the world championship is really much more of a dice roll. So what happens is, during the regular season, a player that gets a $20 million contract is paid in 12 equal installments throughout the season. Okay. So because you get paid every 2 weeks, basically. So you get your first paycheck April 15th, April 30th, you know, May 15th, May 30th, whatever. So in the playoffs, you don't get paid at all. So, but in the playoffs, the TV revenue is the highest because you have national TV. So a team that makes it to the playoffs effectively gets a huge share of the pie versus where, you know, meaning they're selling tickets for crazy prices, right? Mm-hmm. And the advertisers are willing to pay out the ass for those games.
Right.
So you have the net revenue of the playoffs is like on a percentage day by day basis on the calendar, way outsized versus for a team versus like, you know, someday in July or whatever. As a result of that imbalance between what they pay the players in the playoffs and what they keep in the playoffs from revenue, the way that revenue model works, they want to have more playoffs in a shorter regular season because they want to get more from the players for less money. So the, once again, it comes down to money. Players don't want to play extra games because there's a chance of injury every time you go out there, right? Just like a race car driver has a chance of crashing, especially for pitching. The further you put those pitchers into cold weather or excess time throwing baseballs, the more likely they are to have a career ending injury, which I know something about considering I can't touch my neck with my arm. It's very hard for me to touch my neck with my arm because my shoulder and my elbow are so messed up. So, you know, on the player's side, what the players generally want is the players generally want more earning power for younger players so they can earn money in their primes. Because when you earn money towards the end of your career, the issue with that is you tend to get marginalized and then like they can turn the media against you and make you seem like you're, you know, a cuck or whatever. And so there's this interesting dynamic where some teams are more entrepreneurial and they're signing players, younger players for longer contracts because that's when they're in their physical prime. So they say, hey, we might be overpaying for this guy now, but we're going to get him for 8 years at his best 8 years. And so they take that risk. Mm-hmm. And then other teams are more likely to wait for free agents, but there's these battles within the sport, these micro battles, which is to say that, you know, the Yankees have power, the Red Sox have power, the Dodgers have power because they have so much local attendance, people wearing their hats, people wearing their jerseys. So they're able to generate revenue that the Royals might not be able to generate, or the A's, or, you know, the Twins or whatever might not be able to generate, Pittsburgh. So the revenue sharing thing and the luxury tax that they put on salary, on the team salary, that's always fought about. And the higher that number is in terms of what the penalty is, we'll call it the Yankees tax. The worse the Yankees get taxed, the less competitive the Yankees are going to be, which hurts baseball because they're driving salaries by buying the best players. So there's this weird cycle that happens where some players are getting $30, $40 million a year in a sport and other players are being discarded. And that is a very strange thing. But what it comes down to in general is the owners feel like they have the advantage because they have the stadiums. But the thing is, and this is to be really controversial, the players don't necessarily need the owners. As long as the TV networks are willing to pay to have the best players on TV, if the players were all Bitcoiners and basically bought a bunch of Bitcoin, they would have enough money that they could start their own league and they wouldn't need the owners at all. They could actually like basically go buy AAA teams and play in AAA stadiums and people would still show up. People would still go to Round Rock or Sacramento or, you know, Iowa Falls or whatever, they would go to watch the best players and they would watch on TV because those are the best players, the best players. So when a player is locked out conveniently over the winter, there is no alternative for where they can go play. It's not like you can fire up a baseball league in Michigan, you know what I mean? In December, but you could theoretically in June. So this lockout is going to take some time for each side to kind of come up with their sort of, you know, negotiating tactics or whatever. But like, I keep trying to advise the players union to buy Bitcoin with the pension fund. And I keep trying to get them to do that. And it's something that continues to fall on deaf ears. So maybe they have a little bit of free time on their hands now. Maybe they'll listen to me finally. If the players union was buying the dip, they have billions of dollars in pension funds that are there. And it's been a hard battle just to get them to admit it. But I've been yelling at them for approximately 15 years for asset allocation failures, and they still haven't listened to me. So they're probably not going to listen to me because I'm not involved anymore, but I do have some hope that they will start listening to me at some point, or at least they'll listen to somebody else saying the same thing from a different angle. Because I think Bitcoin can save a lot of sports teams and a lot of sports players from themselves, which is to say a lot of them make bad decisions financially, and they tend to get into some crazy debt, you know, problems and stuff like that because they have a high time preference. And that's where Bitcoin can really come in and coach them how to live better.
Yeah. Those are all remarkable points. And it was a very interesting perspective on the baseball lockout. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, CJ. It's always great to speak with you. Please let everyone know where they could find you, your podcast, and the new book.
I'll go out of order. So the book we just wrote, it's on Kickstarter right now. I'm not sure how long it'll be there, depending on when this gets released, but we've like 400% of our goal on that. So we did a Kickstarter for Bitcoin and the American Dream. It's basically written towards policymakers, so you can check that out. We're going to have so Bitcoin and the American Dream.com, I believe, is going to be there. And then Twitter is really where I'm most active. That's Straight Edge Racer, which is STR 8, like the number 8, and then EDGE Racer, RACER. I'm on Instagram, CJ Wilson Photo. Our nonprofit is called the Bitcoin Today Coalition, and that is on Twitter. That is BTC_coalition. And then the website is BitcoinTodayCoalition.org. And if people are interested in getting involved or donating, it is a C4 nonprofit, which means that we do not have to disclose who the donors are. So the benefit of that is if you want to support Bitcoin lobbying legislation and you have some ideas, you can participate as a advisor, or you could volunteer, or you could donate money, and then we'll be converting all that into more efforts to get lawmakers to slow their roll and Senator Karen to just stop. Hopefully Senator Karen just backs off. But we've been getting a lot of really cool traction. We've been having a lot of really cool meetings, and we got a chance to preview a bill. Senator sent us like 167 page bill recently that they're going to come out with in January. We got some early takes on that and had some really good interaction with their office. If this thing comes out, when this thing comes out, Bitcoiners that have been skeptical about politicians are going to they're going to slap themselves right in the face, because this is the single best piece of legislature that has ever and probably could ever happen for Bitcoin. In that regard. So this is the strongest, most positive thing that anybody could do. If I had a wish list, this would have 10 things on it with me not even thinking 5 of these would be possible. So it's fantastic stuff.
Wow, that sounds awesome. CJ, this has been so dope. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ed.
CJ Wilson on Bitcoin and the American Dream, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode was brought to you by Citadel Cabins, CypherSafe, Ledin, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Citadel Cabins exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to CitadelCabins.com to fill out an application now. You bought a hardware wallet, right? So you take your Bitcoin security seriously. Now go that extra step and secure it from physical disaster with a Cypher Wheel or Cypher Grid seed storage device. Go to CypherSafe.io, use the code MATRIX, and get 10% off your order to keep your sats safe. Bitcoin 2022 will be held on Miami Beach from April 6th to 9th. It's going to be off the hook, and you can use the code BitcoinMatrix at checkout to get a 10% discount on your tickets. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix to find out what it's all about and get $50 in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan. And thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and I'll see you in the Bitcoin Matrix. This is Cedric. Peace.